Okay, let's start recording once again. Welcome to this third lecture of the first week of Principles of Banking course 2021. First, I have to make a correction to my yesterday's notes or information about the adoption of Bitcoin in San Salvador. Yes, San Salvador did adopt the Bitcoin, but it's the capital of El Salvador. And El Salvador is the whole country that adopted Bitcoin yesterday. So it's a minor error there, but Salvador anyway. So let's see what happens there within the near future, because, for example, International Monetary Fund is observing really, really closely what is going to be happening there. Is it going to be the Central American center of black markets in the near future, for example? So what kind of role will the Bitcoin get there? But in any case, people are now able to pay, for example, their taxes using Bitcoin to the official systems, tax authorities, and so on. So it's a relevant thing to be really carefully monitored in the very near future. Okay, so let's continue now from the theme of today. That is basically the measurement of interest rates and calculation of interest rates from the prices of interest-yielding assets. So the main idea here in the whole thinking of interest-yielding asset markets is that you should fundamentally understand the idea of present value. So it's all about discounting the future. So you are always, when you make an investment to the real or the investment interest yielding asset markets, then you should be taking into account, first of all, the future stream of income that you get from the investment. And secondly, also, obviously, if you are a sophisticated investor and think like an economist should think, you should be also considering the price development of the general consumer prices. So how do they develop during your investment period? But nevertheless, if we are considering things in nominal terms or real terms, the same idea about discounting should be holding. So by definition, when we talk about present values, we are referring to a monetary value that is paid to you 1 year or somewhere else in the future, depending on the maturity or your investment horizon from now. And that should be less valuable to you than a dollar or any other monetary unit that you have access to now. So this is the simple idea in discount. So a dollar or any other monetary unit deposited today can earn you interest and become a bit higher amount of purchasing power in the future, depending on the value of the interest rate. And now that we have seen already for a longer period of time negative interest rates in European markets, what's your idea about functioning of this general idea? Is it working at all? This is a really fundamental thing. Like I already mentioned in a couple of the last two lectures, that this is a really, really strange thing that is happening now in the markets. We didn't have this possibility in standard textbooks 5 years ago, just before we started to quote negative interest rates in the European markets. How would you consider as yourself if you are being penalized for saving now? What would you prefer to do? Are you willing to save at all? No. You prefer having all your money, your purchasing power, either in the form of plain cash so that you could increase your consumption. That's one possibility, obviously. And we have observed that, for example, in Finland, the amount of cash-like items in the balance sheets of banks and consumers, their customers, it has hugely increased. So people are precautionary at the moment. So the Keynesian, so-called Keynesian precautionary motive for holding cash balances has increased a lot. And the simple reason for that is that the opportunity cost of holding more cash is now negative. There is no cost, basically, of holding more cash. There's a cost of holding more interest-yielding assets because they don't yield interest. It's a cost for you. So that is also one of the reasons why people have been switching their monetary holdings, cash holdings, and so on, towards everything else that is related to the interest-yielding assets. So demand for housing purposes or housing premises, it has increased a lot. Demand for forests, forest capital has increased a lot. Demand for stocks, shares of stocks, has increased a lot. And I am one of the economists in our professional that is willing to blame the central banks that are holding negative interest rates nowadays for this spot behavior. I even made the statement to the general press last year that I would marginally be hoping to see some kind of increases in the interest rate in the very near future. Not too much, because the debt levels are huge at the moment. So all the consumers and the public sector governments, they would soon run into big troubles if the interest rates start to increase a lot and within a very short period of time. So this is a problematic thing that we are now experiencing, because this standard present value idea is not working like we originally planned it to work in these sophisticated economics textbooks. So the real life, once again, is pretty much different than the theoretical ideas are saying. But nevertheless, we have experienced this now. So let's hope that we are able to move towards normal times sooner or later, so that we would be experiencing at least marginally positive interest rates in the near future. So basically, this kind of idea for the calculation of present value for the interest-yielding asset market should be holding. Nowadays, this goes to the other side. We are not getting returns from the interest-yielding investments. If we invest on those, it's a cost. But for some reason or other, the general public and customers have been willing to still hold their monies in at least in the zero interest rate accounts, or even the biggest customers. Also in Finland nowadays, the biggest firm customers in the banking sector are accepting negative deposit rates because they still want to have their money in a safe place. They think that the bank is the safest place almost on earth to be holding your money, monetary assets. Okay, but in normal times, this level of interest rates refers to a 10 percentage points level of interest rate. It's a huge one. It's a kind of a, let's say, too strict example about the idea of discounting and idea of continuously compounding the interest yield or interest return. So nevertheless, if we take a simple example and consider everything on an annual basis, then if you are being paid a nominal interest rate of 10% per annum from your investments, you are able to invest that also for the next year. So this is a principal idea in the so-called compounding. So you are able to invest the proceeds of your first year investments too. So this is the idea that the practical advisors for the general public that are big kings in investment behavior try to sell to people in order to enhance their willingness to save more to interest yielding assets or any other assets. And this is actually the main idea in the so-called stock shares savings account, osakesäästötili in Finland, basically, that you don't have to nowadays pay any taxes if you want to redeem the interest yields and invest that within the same account to stock markets once again. So you are not moving the assets for interest yield to any other account. You only have to pay the tax after you have redeemed the interest yield and moved that to some other account. The OP Group is, I'm sorry to say that they are lacking all the other banks in Finland in introducing this product, but there's basically the same idea behind that product in the banking sector. You can invest the proceeds without any additional costs, but that's in relation to the stock market assets, not interest yielding assets. So this is actually the main idea. But as you see, let's say in 10 years of time, the original amount of investment of 100 can be really much, much more different based on this simple continuity or compounding idea of also the interest yield that you get from your investment. Already in 3 years' time, it would be 133. So it's clearly 33 percentage points return on your investment. So it's bigger than 3 times 10 because you get this compounding based interest yield, interest on interest. So this is the main idea in calculating the present values. So you can use basically this equation for each and every asset that is giving you future streams of income. So you just have to be somehow aware of the general interest rate or the internal rate of required return in your own investment behaviors. So you have some kind of idea that how much you are willing to pay from an asset in the markets at the moment. And you should have an idea that what is the income stream in the future during your holding period of your asset. Let's say if it's a coupon bond that is paying you annually one coupon return, and you are willing to hold that for 5 years. Then you take the price quotation and compare your investment to the interest rate. So based on the general interest rate, you have an idea about the discount rate that you should be using when you evaluate the profitability of investing to that asset in the markets. So basically also in fundamental terms, when you consider investments to stock markets, you should be basically taking a good look at the future prospects of that individual firm. How well is it going to be performing in the future? Because as an owner of that firm, you are entitled to get the residual earnings, the residual profit, the profit that you get as an owner after everyone else has got their share from the profits. And you would be discounting, obviously. As a sophisticated investor, you first take a look at the previous dividends that the firm has been able to pay. So the first fundamental thing in investments to stock markets that you consider when you make a decision whether to invest or not should be the future prospects. And the first thing that you should consider without taking any concerns or paying too much attention to the possible price development of the asset. The first thing should be the dividend yield or the dividends that are being paid in the future. Discount those to the current date and you get the present value. Now that we have observed negative interest rate, also this valuation is a bit problematic because this discount factor is below one if you deduct a negative value from the gross part here. 1 year. So it's a bit problematic thing still in the markets. But nevertheless, the main fundamental thing when you consider the investment decision regarding either interest in assets or stock market should be this promise of future flows of income. These are really simple things, but they are intuitively appealing, at least to me. They are theoretically valid and intuitively quite appealing, at least from a point of view of standard behavior in the markets. So this simple present value cannot compare that directly to the payments scheduled in different points in the timeline, because it might be the case that many things happen during the following years that have an effect on these individual items that you get during the period of maturity of your assets. So basically, the present value should be possible to be calculated like this, but the longer is the investment horizon, the more does it involve uncertainties about how does the main interesting thing here, the interest rate, how does it develop? Is it increasing or is it going down, or what does happen to that? Okay, so it's not very straightforward to compare these future values. But in interest yielding asset markets, or the other title is the credit markets, we are talking about, first of all, simple loans, fixed payment loans, coupon bonds, and discount bonds. Now that we are referring to the bond market, we are discussing about the maturities, usually over 1 year. But you can have bills also, for example, in the US market and also in the European markets. So basically the same ideas, but usually you pay coupon for bonds whose maturities are over 1 year. But the discount bond is an interesting asset because it is actually used as the basis for calculation of the market interest rates also at the short maturities below 1 year. So the main sort of a concept that you should absolutely understand when you are making an interest-yielding asset market investment is the yield to maturity. So you should understand that it is really important to know when you go to the secondary markets, you start to get involved in the trading of an asset that has been issued originally by the issuer to the markets in the primary markets some years ago, perhaps. It has been traded there actively. Buyers and sellers have been active during the course of time. And then you just make a decision that you want to get involved to that market. The first thing that you have to decide is the remaining maturity of that asset. How long is it going to be traded in the market? And you are interested about the calculation of the yield to that maturity. So you should be able to somehow calculate that. So by definition, the yield to maturity is the interest rate that equates the present value of cash flow payments received from a debt instrument with its value today. So it's an interest rate. Moi. Tälle kolme. Mitä? Kuuluuko tätä, näkyykö väärään paikka?
Ei
häiritä ketään, mutta. Okei, eli sorry about the interruption there, but the main thing here is that you should understand the yield to maturity. It's completely dependent on you when you want to engage in that market. Take a look at the yield, the remaining maturity of that asset, and how much do you want to have return from the investment. So you should be able to calculate the yield to maturity, because at the maturity, the original issuer has declared that it will be redeeming the principal. So it's possible to get the principal at the maturity. That's the main idea. Okay, so that's the interest rate that equates the present value of cash flow payments. So this is especially important in the case of constant annual bond payments in the form of coupons. for example. So for the government bond sector, this is really a relevant thing. So yield to maturity on a simple loan can be calculated based on this simple present value equation. So for simple loans, the simple interest rate equals the yield to maturity. That should be pretty straightforward to you. Nothing else comes there during the maturity. Then if you have a case of, for example, government bonds with the maturities more than 1 year, then the same cash flow payment every period throughout the life of the loan is being get it. You get it from the investment, and we denote as the loan value the on the left-hand side, and then you have these fixed yearly payments. At each and every time in the year, they will be paying you, for example, in the form of coupons, a fixed, originally agreed amount of money. And here is the number of years denoted by N. So you simply calculate the current value of all the future payments that you will be getting from this fixed payment loan. Then a coupon bond is a bit different here. It also involves the payment of the face value. So this is basically also you can get a coupon-like return from this one, but the originator or the issuer is not willing to basically pay you the original amount of capital in the maturity. So this is like more standard way or the form of government bonds, for example. So you have this constant yearly coupon payment denoted C, and then the face value at the end of the maturity that the originator or the issuer has promised to pay. But you discount that with the same interest rate all the time. So basically, the further in the future, the more far in the future is the time of point discounting, the lower is the present value of that individual item. Because this guy here, during the normal times when we have positive interest rates, this guy here keeps on increasing its significance or its effect in that valuation equation. So you just have to make first a clear decision on which kind of assets you are willing to invest. So when the coupon bond is priced at its face value, the yield to maturity equals the coupon rate. The price of a coupon bond and the yield to maturity are negatively related. So you have to understand this. This comes from the discounting idea, obviously. Yield to maturity is greater than the coupon rate when the bond price is below its face value. These are all intuitively understandable as long as you understand the relationship between prices and interest rates. So for example, as a practical example, the ECB is through its member central banks heavily active now in the markets for government bonds. And you can get the quotations for those assets regarding the interest rates or yields to maturity that are negative. So based on this idea, what is the principal meaning of the central bank in engaging these markets? What is the other side of the coin when you observe very low interest rates and even negative interest rates in the European sector, banking sector? What is the other side of the coin? It's the price of that asset. So the higher is the price, the lower is the interest rate. And the central bank is more or less deliberately at the moment keeping the prices high so that the governments would get funding based on the prices, not the returns. The governments get the actual funding based on the prices. So if they are issuing new loans to the markets, central banks cannot directly buy those from the governments, at least not yet, hopefully never. But they are issuing those, the governments are issuing those to the banks, to the banking sector in general. And the central bank is buying those from the banks. So banks are being using as a transmitting channel from the government bond markets to the central bank balance sheet, actually. And hence, in this way, when the interest rates are really, really low, even at the negative side, in European level, the governments fundamentally get lots of funds. So basically, now that we are having these budget discussions there in Helsinki today and tomorrow, what to do with the increasing deficit, I should not be too worried, at least in the near term, based on the near-term development, about getting more debt for the government, because the interest rate is still really, really low. It's very low. It's negative. So basically, at the origin of the issuing the loans, the governments have to pay less back than they are originally taking as the amount of loan. This is not something that we as an economists would be very enthusiastic about, because it's violating the principles of having separate decision making for fiscal policy actions and monetary policy actions. Now fiscal policy and monetary policy actions or decisions are very much involved with each other. Central bank is basically playing like a government kind of institution. So that is, we are not too happy about this thing. And that is one of the reasons why we want to get rid of this negative interest rate era in the European markets quite soon. So here's an idea about the calculation of these yields to maturity based on a really, let's say, high positive 10% coupon rate with the base value of $1,000 for a bond. So here you can calculate basically based on that simple discounting idea, you can calculate the years of maturity that are in connection to the interest rate. So the main message from here for you to understand that based on that discounting idea, we're just using that simple equation to discount the calculated year to maturity, you have a negative relationship. When prices are up, yield to maturities are down, and when prices go down, yield to maturities increase. Take a quick look once again at the present value calculation, and you should be able to understand that. Okay, so nowadays we are actually seriously talking about the possibility of these console loans regarding the, especially the government sector loans. Would it be actually necessary in the somewhere in the future for the governments at the ECB level to make a general decision in the Commission, European Commission, that all these loans would be these kind of perpetuities? So they are console loans. They never end. It's a never-ending loan from the central banks to the governments. This is also something that, well, it can be used as a solution for the current situation, but it's something that we basically should be avoiding, because it basically opens a continuous possibility for the governments to get always funding from the central bank. And once again, we are not able to separate fiscal policy from monetary policy. So that is not a thing that we would like to consider. But it's a bond with no maturity date. So the issuer does not pay principals at all, or principal at all, but it pays fixed coupon payments forever. At the origin, it has promised to pay those. So basically, you can calculate the interest rate or the yield to this asset also based on just those fixed yearly coupon payments and divide those with the price of the console loan, so you get the interest rate again. But once again, you have this negative relationship. between the interest rate and the price of the asset. Sorry, there in Zoom, I usually move here a lot and I don't have this moving camera here, so but I try to come back here all the time when I go there. Then we have one possibility, the discount loan, and this is the general form of funding in the money markets. Usually the certificates of deposits of banks, individual banks, like panel banks in the calculation of the Euribor interest rates, the assets are in the form of discount loans. So they are discount bonds and with a very short maturity, and they can be of longer maturities or also, but for any 1 year discount bond, you can calculate the interest rate based on the future face value of the discount bond minus the current price of the discount bond divided by the current price. So once again, do we have a positive or negative relationship between interest rate on this asset and the price? Is it a positive or negative relationship? When the price is low, is the interest rate high or low? This is not even any kind of regression model or correlation thing or anything like that. This is not a difficult animal at all. It's a definition for the calculation of the interest rate for a discount loan. You have the prices and the future face value that is higher than the current price. So the main idea of discount loan is that the current price is lower than the future redemption price or the face value of that loan. So do we have a negative or positive relationship? If any one of you there in Zoom would like to open your microphone, then just shout out the right answer. We have two reasons for a negative relationship. Why? Because first of all, we have that price variable here in the denominator of this definition, and then we have it there with the minus sign in the denominator or numerator. So two reasons for having a negative relationship between interest rate and price. We are continuously talking about the same asset. Price of that asset, how is it related to the interest rate? You have to have this sort of a dictated in the back of your head so that you will be able to immediately realize that when you see low interest rates for any interest yielding assets, it means that it's a high price for that. It has to be because it's based on discount future payments of that asset. You have to understand these things really thoroughly to be able to discuss about this. So the yield to maturity equals the increase in price over the year divided by the initial price. And corresponding to the coupon bond, the yield to maturity is negatively related to the current bond price. Now, based on two reasons. We have the negative side there in the numerator, and in the denominator, we have that P again. Try to remember this intuitively really appealing relationship because it's being used in everything from now on. So we are doing, at the end of the day, we will be doing this supply and demand analysis regarding the money markets based on the price behavior. How much does the quantity of supplied and demanded assets change when the price changes? But you have to understand that when we are discussing about the assets that are interest yielding, then the interest rate goes down if the price goes up. You will be understanding, hopefully this, after we engage in the discussions about the equilibrium in the markets. So equilibrium between supply and demand. Here is the general definition for the gross rate of return of any asset. You have to first consider the possible constant payments during the holding period, irrespective of if it's a interest yielding asset or, for example, a stock market asset. In the stock market case here, in the first animal, we have dividends. You should have some kind of idea whether the firm that you are willing to invest in is able to pay dividends in the future. And the ability to pay dividends is very much dependent on the profitability of the firm in terms of real production and its ability to sell its products with a profit. Then the second thing here that mostly is being actually observed and discussed in the general mass media and financial media is actually the capital return part. So that is the change in the valuation of that asset. This should be familiar for most of you, but perhaps you have not realized that basically this same kind of idea is working also in the interest yielding asset markets and all other asset markets also. So basically you can calculate this kind of return also for currencies, for example, for cryptocurrencies especially. But we don't have any idea about the fundamental thing that would be affecting to the constant part or dividend-like or coupon-like part of the return in the cryptocurrency markets. Because there's basically, we have no idea what are the fundamental things that have an effect on the valuation of those currencies. So the only part of return in the cryptocurrency markets comes from the valuation part. Change in the valuation of that asset during the holding period for you. So that is one of the reasons why economists and sophisticated financial market participants are really, really concerned about this huge development in the cryptocurrency markets, because we are lacking the idea of fundamental things that have an effect on the valuation there. So basically, you can calculate this kind of return for every asset. When you come to me and you want to do a thesis about development of or correlations or interrelationships between different sectors of financial markets, you have to be very careful first defining what are the components that have an effect on the return and how do you want to measure the returns. A very simple approximation for the value chains is the log difference of the prices. We will be discussing and using that in the time series course next spring term, but basically that is a approximation for this part in the calculation of the returns. Okay, so distinction between interest rates and returns. Return equals the yield to maturity only if the holding period equals the time to maturity. I have emphasized the holding period idea all the time. It's very much a subjective thing. It depends on your preferences. How long do you want to have the asset? It can be completely different than the maturity, time to maturity. If you want to engage into the markets for 10-year bonds, 10-year government bonds, you could be holding those in your portfolio only for 2 years. And the time to maturity could be 5 years. So it's a different time period. So you have to calculate for your own purposes the time to your own maturity, not the overall whole maturity of the asset. So holding period is really, really relevant. You have to decide that always. Rising interest rates is associated with the fall in bond prices. You should now understand this, resulting in a capital loss if time to maturity is longer than the holding period. Once again, the difference between the holding period and the maturity, term to maturity, is the key thing. The more distant a bond's maturity is, the greater the size of the percentage price change, relative price change associated with an interest rate change. Once again, simply based on that previous equation in general terms for the calculation of the returns. Interest rates do not always have to be positive, as we have now evidenced by recent experience in Japan and several European countries. They don't have to be positive. 5 years ago, we didn't have this mentioning in any courses of banking because we didn't realize, actually, we were so stupid that we didn't realize that if you calculate the interest rates based on price changes, obviously they can go below zero. Obviously, if you don't have declared by the central bank an absolute lower level like the Federal Reserve has declared, the absolute lower level for the interest rates is the zero. It is not allowing to be quoted negative interest rates. So that is the key difference here. And one of the reasons why in the European scale it is possible is that because the bank of the European Central Bank started to quote negative interest rates for the biggest banks for their deposits in the central bank. So they sort of skipped the idea of having absolute lower bound at the zero level. That is the main reason, actually, why. And Bank of Sweden actually was the first European bank that started to do that. So they had a really strong belief that in any case, even though you are paying negative interest rate to the deposits that the firms are making to the central banks, to the banking sector, nevertheless, the firms would be willing to do that. And the banks would be willing to do that. They would be willing to deposit their excess reserves to the central bank with the negative interest rate. So they are basically paying a cost of depositing funds to the central bank. And they were successful in that. They had the right assumption that they are willing to do that. So this is very much related to the general situation in the uncertainty, the aggregate level of the economy. If everything else seems to be really uncertain, it's very uncertain to invest to stock markets or to other banks, for example. One really reliable guy as a counterparty for banks is the central bank. So even though they are charging -0.3, originally -0.16 actually, percentage points from your deposits, you are willing to do that. So you are getting less back from your deposit at the end of the day, at the maturity of the deposit, than you did at the origin of the deposit. Okay, so this is a strange thing that has happened, and it's still working quite strongly in the markets. So the more distant is the bond's maturity, the lower the rate of return that comes as a result of an increase in the interest rate. So interest rates in general terms have an effect on the each individual asset's rate of return. So even if a bond has a substantial initial interest rate, its return can be negative if interest rates rise in general, if the general level of interest rates is increased. So this is just to emphasize that you have to be able to somehow calculate the rate of return for the asset that you are considering to be an investment for you. So here we have these examples as an example for you regarding the role of the yield to maturity when the bond is purchased. So you can engage into the markets and take a look at what is the yield or what is the term to maturity. How long time will it take when the asset matures? So it will be redeemed by the initial offer. Initial current yield has been given to be the constant, 10%. Initial price has been 1,000. Price next year here is, as an example, we are giving here a set of prices. So you can basically calculate as a price change based on the relative price change between initial price and price on that year, you can calculate the capital gain. So you are here losing because the difference is really big. You are here losing also, and you are still losing here, but it goes to zero at the very near maturity. So basically, you can calculate the rate of return for these investments based on that gross return equation that I gave you yesterday and these columns 2 and column 5 in this table. So basically here, when the time to maturity is quite short, you can get positive returns in gross terms from this investment. But the further is the time to maturity, the more starts the interest rate discounting idea play there a role. So you are losing the more, the longer is the term to your maturity, or the maturity of that asset. So basically this can be calculated based on a financial, using a financial calculator, and we are using that discounting equation that I've given there in the previous slides. So basically this should give you an idea that the more far in the future the actual payment date of a item that is giving you yield or income, the more far it is, the more there is risk that you would be losing money actually. In the near future, the occasions that take place in the near future based on the payments, they are giving you positive yield here. So here at the 1 year maturity, the only thing that has an effect on your return, gross return, is obviously this, because there's no change in the value of the asset at all. But there's a, so these are assumptions for the prices. Obviously you get different results if you have different assumptions, but this is a kind of a reflective example for you about the calculation of the overall return. So you calculate the initial current yield. So this is the promised yield every year, regardless of the maturity or the term to maturity, and then the capital gain part, changing the valuation of the asset. So those together determine the gross return for that investment. So when you make a decision to be engaged with the investments that have a time to maturity of 5 years, you should be able to make an observation about the prices, have an idea about the initial promised coupon yield for that asset, and then calculate the difference between the initial price and the price that seems to be coming in the next period after your decision to make an investment. That gives you the idea about the capital gain. Okay. Basically, for stock markets, you should be also able to calculate these kind of things, but this is different there. You don't have an idea about the years to maturity because it's completely dependent on your holding period. How long are you willing to hold? Your holding period can be different also for the fixed income markets, but nevertheless, the ultimate thing that's happened effect in terms of the time dimension is the years to maturity. All right. So, maturity and the volatility. Obviously, you are interested about the variation in the interest rates. So, originally, variation the prices of interest-yielding assets. So, prices and returns for long-term bonds are more volatile than those for shorter-term bonds. Why is that? Obviously, based on this table, you should be able to make this conclusion, because the rate of returns in overall cross terms vary quite a lot the longer is the term to maturity. So obviously, if the rates of returns vary a lot, then the volatility of those returns also varies a lot the longer is the term to maturity. There's no interest rate risk for any bond whose time to maturity matches the holding period. So the only risk comes from the difference that you are not willing to hold the asset until its maturity. Okay. So there's no interest rate risk in there, but there is the risk for the changes in the value of the asset. So that is something that is still included there. So I have many times already now emphasized these ideas between the nominal values and real values. as an economist, you should always be basically using real values, because in our models, the real things are the ones that you want to be able to consume. Real investments are the thing that are part of the GDP calculations, and you want to consume everything in real terms. So usually we have been very worried about the effects of inflation. In real life observations from the, let's say, years after the global financial crisis, inflation has not basically played so big role. But once again, if you start thinking about these interest yielding asset markets, then you should immediately realize that even with the fairly low rates of inflation, the real rates of interest rates can be really low if the nominal interest rates are below zero. So if the real rate of interest is nominal interest rate minus inflation rate, and nominal interest rate is already at the minus side, and then you take the inflation effect from that, the real rate is even more at the minus side. So it's really, really low. So in terms of, for example, incentives for the firm sector to build up factories and all these other things, they should have had very good incentives in recent times in terms of the real interest rate for the loans that they are paying, because they have been really low, really very low, because we have experienced positive inflation rates, even though very low, around 1-2%. In annual terms, nevertheless, it is a thing that is still positive. So you, if you take that effect from the negative interest rate in nominal terms, then you get even more negative thing in the real interest rate. And this is a bit surprising that this has not encouraged, for example, the firm sector in Finland or the enterprise sector to make more real investments, because the cost of funding in real terms has been really, really low. The main reason for that is the uncertainty in the economy. Will this, for example, now that we are surviving from the COVID crisis, will this hold? Will this last? Or is the next pandemic, for example, coming? Someone in the laboratories of China are making an error once again, and things can evolve soon to a really, really problematic thing. So it's also an interesting thing that we have observed now. Then actually, also you have, in terms of economic analysis, you have to be always careful when we are discussing about ex-ante real rates of interest and exposed real rates of interest. Exposed real rates of interest can be calculated only after we have observed the inflation rates. Ex-ante real rates of interest are based on inflation expectations. And in before the global financial crisis, especially, the central banks were mainly focusing on inflation expectations. They were interested about having a very stable path of inflation expectations around 2% level of the core inflation, where the role of energy products and some other things has been taken care of. So basically, this is something that the central banks have been focusing quite a lot. For that purpose, you have to somehow calculate, define the expectations of inflation. So they are using sophisticated models to calculate those, and they are using consumer inquiries, for example, what are the consumer sector expectations regarding the inflation, because they made the monetary policy decisions based on those partly. So make a distinction between these. For example, the original idea of the so-called Fisher equation, has anyone of you ever heard about Fisher equation? Okay, so that gives you an idea about the difference between how to calculate nominal and real interest rates. And it's not just a definition for the calculation of real interest rates. It's a behavioral thing, because the behavioral thing there is, first of all, the nominal interest rates. They are dependent on the market valuation of the interest-earning assets and activities of central banks. And also the expected inflation is not a constant thing. It changes over time and it is dependent on things. So how do you model the expectations? It's actually very relevant. I even did my PhD on this really simple thing. How are the inflation expectations in the Finnish economy? How are they defined? What are the relevant things that have an effect on inflation expectations? Nowadays, expectations and exposed values have been pretty much the same for a longer period of time, because for some reason or other, we have been living these very low inflation level times now for a longer period of time. But let's see now what is happening now that we have started the recovery from the COVID crisis, because in the US case, for example, inflation rate is increasing really quite fast. And yesterday we got news that at the European level also, inflation has been around 3%, and that is 1% above the target of the ECB. So what is the ECB going to be doing? It will probably start increasing the interest rates for the sake of controlling the inflation, not for the sake of saving these models and discounting ideas, but for the sake of controlling inflation. So it's very practically oriented in those terms. Here's the Fisher equation. So I paid a lot of attention in my PhD thesis to model this guy. How is it possible to derive a reliable inflation expectations measure for the Finnish economy at the time when we experienced the liberalized money markets? So we had these Helibor rates before the euro period of time. Probably most of you were not even born when I was writing this first paper of my thesis. So I paid a lot of attention based on the history of inflation. Is it possible to forecast the future value and then generate the expectations based on those forecasts, based on a so-called autoregressive moving average time series models? And what are the effects of various kinds of shocks there? Do they have a permanent effect, or do they have an effect on the level of inflation or variance of inflation, or do you have a shock type effect that lasts for a while, or what kind of effects do they have? So I was able to construct a better inflation expectation measure than, for example, the Research Institute of the Finnish Economy and Bank of Finland, based on simple Arima models, where I paid a lot of attention to extract the effect of shocks, shock type events to the actual inflation rate. So it's a behavioral thing, actually, quite a lot. It reacts to many things. And it's a very much a macroeconomic thing, even though basically all these guys like nominal interest rates are very much macroeconomic things. Nevertheless, their quotations are being done in the financial markets. So the financial market participants more or less decide the level of interest rates, basically, because we have huge amount of assets in the interest rate asset markets. But nevertheless, the main idea here is that if you calculate the real interest rate based on this simple Fisher definition, so this is now definition. When the real interest rate is low, there are greater incentives to borrow and fewer incentives to lend. That should be the main idea. Real interest rate is a better indicator of the incentives to borrow and lend than the nominal interest rate, because it's related to the real consumption possibilities and real production possibilities. So that is one of the reasons. Here we have an example of this. Real and nominal interest rates from the US case. So we see here that actually the difference between the nominal interest rate in general terms after 1980s has between the nominal and estimated real rate. So the estimation means here that you have constructed a series of inflation expectations to be able to estimate or calculate the real interest rate based on inflation expectations. So the difference between these two guys, it has actually decreased quite a lot. So nowadays, when we are experiencing this zero lower bound nominal interest rate era in the US economy, we are still experiencing that. The real rate of interest has been below zero because inflation rate has been positive and inflation expectations have been positive. And in the European context or ECB context and Finnish context, these guys have both been below zero. This is actually one of the reasons why some of the US economists were actually a bit disturbed about this thing that because of this zero lower bound that the Federal Reserve governors decided to have. The interest rates, short-term interest rates, are really not reflecting the actual situation in the macroeconomy or in the markets. And that is the reason why they wanted to start to do a sophisticated econometric model to construct a so-called shadow interest rate, shadow nominal interest rate, that can go below zero. It is based on a huge amount of information from interest yielding asset markets. So basically, it's based on using a term structure of interest rates models and factor analytical statistical tools. And they have been able to construct then a shadow interest rate that actually follows much more closely also the development of macroeconomic indicators during the zero lower bound era. And the nominal interest rate, really the quoted nominal interest rate in the markets, cannot go below zero. So even though the economy goes down heavily and the interest rate should be lowered, central bank has decided that it will not lower those below zero. The real effective monetary policy rate, the shadow rate, is actually the one that captures this possibility that it should go below zero. Wu and Xia are the ones that have been doing research on that. And in the European context the Juha Kortala has actually calculated Bank of Finland a corresponding measure for the ECB area. It's based on the IDF term structure of interest rate that we'll be discussing actually also in this course. So there's a difference. We do all the analysis in this course based on demand and supply things. So the first thing about this analysis is to decide what are the relevant things that have an effect on, first of all, the demand of assets and what are the relevant things that affect the supply of assets. So we realize that economic agents hold various assets. What are the primary assets you hold? An asset is anything that can be owned and has a value. You can own an asset, it has a value, so it's a stock measure. You can measure the amount of assets that you have at certain point of time. Let's say, for example, at the end of the year, you can measure the number of forestries, real estate, stocks, and interest yielding assets, also currencies, even cryptocurrencies. And they take the value from the markets for those things, each of those items, and multiply that with the number of those assets, you get the value of your portfolio. Your asset portfolio's value is determined at a certain point of time. So what are the things that have an effect here? Overall wealth, obviously, total resources owned by the individual, including all assets, then expected returns, and to be actually more exact here, expected relative returns are important. You always compare the return from some asset to another asset. That is in the set of possibilities that you would be able to buy or acquire. So the return expected over the next period on one asset relative to alternative assets. The risk for most of you is also important. And the simplest measure or the definition for the risk is simply the variation in the value or the variation in the return. So it's a degree of uncertainty associated with the return on one asset relative to alternative assets. So always we are speaking in relative terms because we want to compare against all the other possibilities. Then liquidity is also one thing that has an effect, which refers to the ease and speed with which an asset can be turned into cash. Cash is always irrespective of its form. Cash can be nowadays in many forms. It can be digital cash or coins and notes, even cryptocurrencies. In some countries are starting to be denoted as cash because they are payment. They are it's possible to pay things with those things. Or those funds. So how easy it is to translate your returns to plain cash or something comparable to the plain cash. So in economic analysis, we always have to assume that we cannot change everything at the same time. So this is really, really partial analysis. So we have to make this ceteris paribus assumption. So we assume here always that nothing else than this individual item that are being listed here, four items here, change. So ceteris paribus assumption holds. The quantity of assets demanded is positively related to wealth. The more you have wealth, the more you are demanding assets in general terms. So there's a positive wealth effect. If you want to derive a function for the demand of assets, then the first derivative of the demand with respect to the overall wealth is positive in terms of mathematical notations that the economists are very used to be using. Quantity demanded of an asset is positively related to its expected return. So the first derivative with respect to the expected return relative to other assets is also positive for the demand, and negatively related to the risk of returns. So the first derivative with respect to the variation in the returns, volatility of returns, is negative regarding the demand. Quantity demanded is positively related to its liquidity. The easier it is to transfer your proceeds from investment to plain cash, the more you are willing to do that. The more you are willing to invest in this asset. So basically, we have a table about the partial effects. Remember that we are assuming that changes in expected return do not immediately have an effect on the overall wealth. It's a bit ridiculous assumption because obviously, if the expected return on your holdings in your assets is increasing, it will be increasing your wealth in the near future. But here we just want to do this contemporaneous analysis, assuming that other things don't change immediately. If any of these items changes now, in the next period, obviously it has had an effect on all the other things also, probably. But we have to do this simplifying assumption to be able to do any kind of analysis. Supply and demand in the bond market at lower prices, corresponding to higher interest rates, based on that discounting idea. The quantity, assuming everything else stays the same, the quantity demanded at bonds is higher. We have an inverse relationship. Remember that. That is the main thing. We are doing the analysis based on quantities and prices, but remember that in the same vertical axis, we actually also measure simultaneously the rate of return or the interest development. The higher the price, the lower the interest rate at the same value. So low interest rate values are connected to high price values, and you can get the quantity amount from the horizontal axis. Okay, at lower prices, higher interest rates, the quantity supplied of bonds is lower. So we have a positive relationship. This is the main equilibrium relationship in these markets. So we have the demand equation and we have the excess or the supply equation there. So this is referring, BV is referring to the demand equation, BS is referring to the supply equation. So if we are in some other point than in the equilibrium point, we are either in the situation of excess demand or in the situation of excess supply. So basically, the thing that starts to adapt is not immediately the interest rate. Yes, it will be changing also, depending on your holding period and the time to maturity and so on. But the thing that starts to react is the price. So we have plotted this price axis here to the vertical axis, and the quantity of bonds is here. So basically, now that central banks are really active in government bond markets, this kind of very simple equilibrium relationship is holding there. They want to meet the supply, excess supply of assets, interest yielding assets by the banking sector that have been originally issued by the governments. So they are doing the demand. Central banks are doing the demand. The banking sector and originally the governments are doing the supply. So the central banks basically have some kind of idea what should be the relevant equilibrium price and what should be the relevant interest rate. And in the Federal Reserve case or the US markets, these values are still above zero. But in the European ECB markets, euro area markets, they are below zero. So the equilibrium point in the US markets is completely different compared to the European or the ECB euro area markets. When we have an excess demand situation, so when you take a look at this, values here in the horizontal axis, here the value that is being picked from the horizontal axis that is related to the demand curve is clearly bigger than the corresponding value at this price and this interest rate for the supply. So we have here an amount of 400 billion euro, billion dollars of excess demand. Okay. And in the correspondingly in the other situation, here we have an excess supply situation. So the thing that starts to adapt to this situation is the price. When you have, this is intuitively really, it should be really easy to understand that when you have excess supply, it has to be the case that the price comes down because you cannot able to supply everything that you are willing to supply at that price. You have to lower the price. When you have excess demand, the price has to start to increase because there's not enough supply to meet the demand. But now in the interest yielding asset markets, you have to understand that it's in negative relationship to the interest rates for those assets. After you have sort of realized this situation, you are actually able to understand why are the central banks so active now in these government bond markets and every other segments of the bond markets and also other interest yielding asset markets. They want to supply the funding in terms of having low interest rates and high amounts of funding to the government sector and every other sector that is in need for funding. So the amount of money is obviously for each and every item of issued asset, the amount of money is obviously related to the price. Price times the number of assets gives you the amount of funding, how much you have funding for other purposes. This is actually a really nice thing. If you understand this completely, then you are able to discuss many much more difficult things in relation to the, for example, monetary policy actions and also unconventional monetary policy actions. But basically, this chain of events or these ideas are playing there at the background of both conventional, the standard monetary policy actions, and in unconventional times. The composition of the assets is just a bit different. In normal conventional monetary policy times, central banks are mainly dealing at the short maturity of assets with the banking sector. But now that we have enlarged, or they have enlarged their portfolio of assets, they are also now heavily dealing at the very long-term maturities of these assets. So the market equilibrium is there. I love these things so much, but usually I run out of the time. But the market equilibrium is this defined by this idea that when the demand equals the supply, we have the equilibrium rate. We have the equilibrium rate for the interest and corresponding quotation for the prices. And we get the quantity of the assets from the horizontal axis. And we have these two things. So when the central bank wants to have an effect on the level of interest rates, then it will be engaging into these asset markets for interest-yielding assets. And in normal times, when it's doing these conventional monetary policy actions, it's mainly playing at the short maturity, money market maturities with the banking sector. But in unconventional times, we have been now experiencing that the central banks are really active also in the other segments or the other maturities. So there are things that have an effect on these. We already listed these things that have an effect on the demand. So obviously the same things have an effect on the equilibrium values of the interest rates. In an expansion with growing wealth, demand curve for bonds shifts to the right. Now that we are discussing about the equilibrium point, we are obviously interested about the movements in those curves. How do the demand curves move their positions, or the demand curve does move its position, and how does the supply curve get to be located where it is? Expected returns, higher expected returns, or expected rates of interest in the future lower the expected return for long-term bonds, shifting the demand curve to the left. Expected inflation in terms of real values of interest rates is also important. An increase in the expected rate of inflation lowers the expected return for bonds, causing the demand curve to shift to the left in real terms. Risk has an effect also, because it has an effect on the demand originally. If the risk increases, it causes demand curve to go to the left. Liquidity has a positive effect, so it will be moving the demand curve to the right. So the things that have an effect on actual amount of demand do also have an effect on the location of the demand curve. So if there comes a change in these, it also changes ceteris paribus. So here we are assuming that nothing happens that has an effect on the supply. We are considering the things that have an effect only on the demand. So the location of the demand equation, or the demand curve, is the thing. So an increase in the demand shifts the bond demand curve to the right. So at each and every price of the bonds, the amount is bigger. That's the main message. Each and every price of the bond, the amount is bigger. So here's a short summary table about the variables that have an effect on the location. This is the same thing that we already went through. And the other party, or the counterparty in the markets, is the one that is supplying those bonds. So the things that have an effect on the supply of bonds are, first of all, the expected profitability of investment opportunities. And we are now talking about real investments. So we are now going to the very origin for the needs of the funding in the form of bonds in this case. So if the expected profitability of the, for example, factories that the industrial sector is willing to build, they are, or the governments are willing to build, let's say, railways and the network of roads. They want to build up new buildings for universities, for example. Then they have a need for funding. So they issue the bond to get the funding. So if the investment profitability is increasing, and in an expansion it is usually increasing, the supply curve shifts to the right. Expected inflation is the same factor that has an effect on the demand curve. It also has an effect on the supply curve. So if there's an increase in expected inflation, it will shift it to the right, supply curve to the right. Government budget in terms of government bonds, increased budget deficits shift the supply curve to the right. So remember always that we are talking about demand and supply of those assets. Not actually the assets are being transformed to form the liquidity when they pay for these real investments, like build the factories or build the roads and build the new buildings for the universities. So we are talking about asset demand all the time. So factors that have an effect on these supply curves locations are listed here. So basically, when we are talking about changes in these, so increase in the supply of bonds shifts the supply bond curve rightwards, and the equilibrium point changes are given here. We have a set of common things that have an effect on both the demand and supply of these bonds. First of those was expected inflation. So if there, for some reason or other, comes a kind of an exogenous effect on inflation expectations, like for example in Finland, it might well be the case that because the US economy has now started to increase quite heavily and the European economy is following that, it might be the case that expected inflation due to the increases in the raw material, for example, starts to increase also in Finland. So it will have an effect on the demand and supply of the Finnish government bonds. And that is actually something that the people that are now discussing, that actually the inflation risk is not really very high. It is actually increasing at the moment. And it will be having an effect on the government bond supply and demand. So let's suppose that those pressures in the ECB area, also European, they will also materialize in the Finnish case. So it will have an effect on the bond demand curve for the Finnish government bonds also. So it will be shifting that to the leftwards. And as you remember from the previous slides, it also has an effect on the supply curve. So what is the resulting situation in terms of the interest rate? Prices go up, so the interest rate comes down. And that is just based on an exogenous shock to the Finnish government bond markets that comes from outside our economy, actually. So this is the real thing that may well happen without any intervention of the central bank. This can materialize. So it will have an effect on the location of the equilibrium point in the Finnish government bond markets. So it's not just out of curiosity that we are discussing about these things. This can really happen, and they have an effect on the equilibriums in the asset markets, for example, for the Finnish government bonds. So we see here actually that expected inflation is really a relevant factor in terms of determining the levels of interest rates in historical terms. If you take a look at the variation or change points in these series, you see that they have a sort of a joint slope occasionally. So we see that expected inflation is actually also in nowadays, it's very relevant thing that you have to be concerned about. It will have an effect on the interest rate sooner or later. At least after in March, the ECB's next March, the ECB is going to be starting withdrawal of the pandemic emergency purchase program. That is the latest form of unconventional monetary policy actions. It might be the case that if it completely shuts down that program, it might actually have quite a strong effect on the interest rates in the markets. And if it starts to shut down also the other programs, so the economy, real economy seem to be performing quite well, it might have reasons to shut down the other programs also gradually. So the interest rate would start to increase also in the other interest earning asset segments, not just in the government sector, but also in the money market maturities. So expected inflation is actually really, really important. It will have an effect on the valuation of these bonds. If there's a response to the business cycle, we observed earlier that it also will have an effect on the location of both the demand and supply curves. If there comes an expansion, like we have already seen, real economic expansion, also in the euro area, it shifts the bond supply curve rightward based on our assumptions, and it also has an effect on the demand curve. So the demand curve will also be moving to rightward. So the red lines are the new positions, but not necessarily so much because all the other things that are in connection actually to the expansion have an effect on there too. So it will probably not be moving so much as the supply curve, but nevertheless, we have a situation here where the price of bonds goes down and again, equilibrium interest rate increases. So this is actually, it's good to have expansionary economy, that the real economy is developing it well. Let's say it has a good pace in terms of the business cycle, but it will have an effect also on the interest rates. Everything here takes place assuming that the central bank does not do anything. If it wants to have an effect on these new locations, then it will start to be involved more heavily also in those markets once again. But we would like to see the situation where the central bank is not so active, at least in the markets for the longer term bonds, like the government bonds. So it would be able to go more towards normal, conventional monetary policy actions and times of that. Okay, but we have also once again historical evidence that the business cycles and interest rates are related to each other. So during the slacks or the slowdowns, here we have the recession times from the US economy, we see that the interest rate goes down. And during the upturns, actually, we see that the interest rates start to increase. Yes, the global financial crisis event or 2008-2009, and we saw really strong decrease in the interest rates, and in the US economy they hit the zero lower bound there. They have been staying there. Actually, in the US economy they started to try to get rid of this zero interest rate era. So the interest rates were seen to be increasing already in 2017, but since we had this pandemic crisis, they lowered the interest rate once again to the zero level and started these extreme buying programs once again. So they are really low still there. But the inflation pressures in the US economy are really strong now. they are experiencing quarterly rates of inflation that are corresponding to the annual rate of inflation of over 4%. That is unexpectedly high thing there. So we will be seeing interest rate hikes in the US case quite soon. And ECB will probably start to follow those. There are already news about withdrawal of these unconventional monetary policy programs. Yeah.
Yeah, but the FED also has some goals regarding inflation.
Yeah. That's the other thing. That's the other thing.
Contradiction between high inflation rate and unexpectedly low inflation.
So yeah, we will be discussing about those in terms of the Taylor rule for the monetary policy actions. That is the standard rule where the central bank has two main targets. The first one is the inflation rate or the stabilization of the inflation rate, and the other one is real economic activity. And it's playing, in normal times, it's playing with these things. But during unconventional monetary policy actions, it's really difficult to say what is the real target of the central bank. It's trying to enhance the real economic activity, yes, for sure. But the sort of instruments that it is using for that, they are really unconventional. It comes through the funding of the government sector, also the corporate sector. So basically, it's something that's not related to the standard tools of its monetary policy toolbox. So it's playing there in the longer maturities. Sort of a background idea is still to have an effect, a positive effect on the real economic activity. But it has been actually mainly done for the sake of saving the financial markets. Actually, it has been building up these kind of bubbles in some segments in financial markets, probably. But as sort of a kind of a side effect, for example, the US economy has now started to recover really, really strongly after the pandemic crisis. And it was actually doing that right before the crisis also, it had been doing very well since 2010 already. So they had an idea that they would be able to get rid of this unconventional monetary policy period, but the COVID crisis changed everything there also. We will be discussing about this. It was a good point there that the other thing that central banks should be focusing on is the real economic activity. And the business cycle is actually one indicator of the real economic activity. Employment is another indicator. It's just about the decision on how you measure the real economic activity. Okay. So basically, we have now discussed the most important ideas in the supply and demand relationships in the bond markets. Now that we are start the discussion about the central bank's role, we have to make a decision or we have to make the or realize that actually in the short-term maturities, the central bank more or less dictates the amount of supplied funds. So it dictates the amount of money in the economy. So that's the reason why the supply curve of money is completely vertical. Central bank has the single right, or it's the single authority that can issue and print money, actually. That's the origins of this idea. But basically, we can do this analysis using these same kind of things, that what are the relevant factors that have an effect on the demand, and how does the central bank determine the position of the supply curve. So take a look at these slides. Rest of these slides in view of the discussions that we did already regarding the bond markets. Now we are discussing the money markets, short-term instruments below 1 year maturity. And the provider or the supplier of those assets is the central bank. So compare these discussions to the discussions that we had about the longer-term case, the bond markets, so you are able to analyze these changes in the positions of demand and supply curves also. So at the end of the day, you should be able to understand that what are the effects of the what are the partial effects of the things that have an effect on these demand and supply curves. So take a look at these slides. Actually, until this slide, where we start the discussion about zero lower bounds, take a look at all these slides independently. Based on those, prepare for the weekly quiz on next Friday. And I will give you some more instruction about how to prepare for the next week's first lecture, because you have to take a look at the term structure of interest rate ideas in the later slides before we can start the discussion of negative interest rates. And it's a relevant part or relevant point of time here to take the discussion about negative interest rates, because you have just discussed about these unconventional monetary reactions recently. So let's discuss about the theoretical ideas behind why the central banks might be using these negative interest rates. So for the first week's weekly quiz, all the slides before this slide is the material for the first week quiz. 5 questions in 15 minutes between 4 and 6 on Friday evening, just before weekend. So you can have all the material there. Just try to read that carefully before the quiz, and you can have it still there, but it's impossible to start going through the pages or scrolling down the slides there during the test. So prepare in advance. Okay, and let's meet again next week on Wednesday. I will send through Moodle more instructions about next week's first lecture. Okay, have a nice week. Thank you.